Tonight on Arena, just how good is the CAA at writing 4-minute power ballads? And If It Bleeds, a quartet of new stories from Stephen King. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The anthem, adopted to celebrate the fall of communism and the peaceful reunification of Germany, or a secret CIA propaganda tool which fooled the masses? That's the question being asked about the Scorpions' 1990 hit Wind of Change in the new 8-part podcast series also entitled Wind of Change. It's available to enjoy in full right now on Spotify, and it's written and presented by New Yorker columnist and prominent investigative journalist Patrick Radden Keefe. We'll talk to Patrick shortly, but first, let's hear some of the song that whetted his investigative appetite from the album Crazy World, Wind of Change, from the Scorpions.
Follow the Moskva down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change.
Wind of Change from the Scorpions, or should I say from the CIA, because that, as I said, is the question being asked in the new 8-part podcast series also entitled Wind of Change, written and presented by Patrick Radden Keefe, who joins me now from New York. Patrick, people here might know you from your 2019 book Say Nothing, which used the disappearance of Jean McConville as the starting point to investigate atrocities carried out in Northern Ireland, or indeed your work around the opioid crisis, particularly in your own country. Now, a conspiracy theory around the CIA writing a power ballad to reunify Germany doesn't quite sound as if it's in the same serious investigative ballpark.
Bit of a change of tune, eh? Yeah. You know, it's funny. I spent a good chunk of the last 5 years working on this book, Say Nothing, about the Troubles, a fairly grim subject matter. And this podcast was the first thing I did coming out of that. I had gotten this crazy tip years ago from a trusted source that he'd heard from somebody at the CIA, that the CIA had actually written that song. And so that started me off on this this journey. And it was a very nice, I mean, this, you know, the stakes are somewhat lower, as you say. So it was a very fun thing to do.
Yeah, but those are very investigative journalist words. I got this tip from a trusted source. Now, yeah. you can tell me a little bit about the source, really, because he's a very good pal of yours, and you admit to who that source is, well, part of the source, if you like, in the very first episode of the podcast series, in fact.
Yeah, so there's this guy, my friend Michael, who's a bit of an international man of mystery himself. He works for Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State for the U.S., but he's also very involved in international business, and he's done business intelligence work over the years, and he knows a lot of spies. And he's a dear old friend of mine, but over the years, he has fed me little tidbits occasionally that have blossomed into stories for me. And so I tend to take anything he tells me pretty seriously. And in this instance, I was doubly intrigued because the guy who related the story to him, this ex-CIA guy, is somebody who I've also met. I had met this guy through him. And so someone who, you know, I had a bit of a feel for, and I had a sense this guy was not a, you know, he wasn't somebody to fabricate such a story.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how much Irish you learned during your time here, but there's a saying in the Irish language which goes, Dirchban lum, gnirchban lehi, which basically means, a woman told me that a woman told her. You can go on and on. And a man told her that his brother did this, and it was his uncle that actually was the source of the story in the beginning. And we might come back to how reliable Michael indeed, perhaps, and Oliver might be. We'll come back to all of that. But let's get a sense of Wind of Change itself, the song. Now, you can hear it in the lyrics there. Did you ever think that we could be so close, like brothers? The future's in our hands, you know, can feel it everywhere. Take me to the magic of the night. All of, you know, we're looking at very exciting events. How important was it, and how linked was it, in fact, to the reunification of Germany?
Well, so the song, to get into the specifics of the song, it was written actually before the wall came down, but it wasn't released until afterwards. So what happened is that the band, the Scorpions, had gone and played in Moscow in the summer of 1989, which was quite a big thing because rock and roll had effectively been banned in the Soviet Union during the Cold War. There was a sense that the Kremlin had that it was quite dangerous to communist control, obviously very associated with the West. But there was a bit of opening up, and the band had gone to Moscow in the summer of 89. And then after that, they record this song. And the song becomes kind of an anthem for the reunification of Germany, but then also very, very influential among young people in the Soviet Union. And it kind of spreads like wildfire. It goes to number one on the charts all across Europe in 91. And really is the soundtrack, you know, once the wall has fallen, to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So it was, for me, looking into it, it actually makes a certain amount of sense that it would dovetail with U.S. interests. But also going, which I did for the podcast, I mean, going to St. Petersburg and Moscow and Ukraine and interviewing fans to a degree that I perhaps didn't fully appreciate. The song is not just a song for them. It's this massive cultural and political touchstone.
Of course, that's still a long way off the CIA writing it for it to become exactly that, or indeed for it to have the effect of reunifying Germany. That's a pretty powerful thing for any piece of music to do. But if you wanted to add to the conspiracy theory element of this, the song itself and the album, indeed, Crazy Album, or Crazy World, rather, the album from which it comes, this was a change from the norm for the Scorpions, both in terms of the songwriting process and where the album was recorded. So maybe the CIA spooks did get to them and pull them to the one side and say, here, come here, let's do this together. It kind of feeds into that, doesn't it?
It does. But I mean, this was the whole experience for me of chasing down this story. You know, normally you hear a story like that, and as you say, it's a woman told me that a woman told her. It's got this kind of third hand quality. You know, the expression journalists would sometimes use is it's too good to check. And I get stories like that all the time. I mean, they come to me in my inbox, people tip me off to things, and I'll kind of look at them and kick the tires. And usually it just seems like there's less there, you know, than it seemed at first. This is one of these funny stories where the more I dug into it, you would have thought the less plausible it would seem, but the more I dug, the more plausible it seemed. And so some of it is the kind of thing you're getting at, where turns out Klaus Meine, who wrote the song, didn't usually write songs. This was quite different, in fact, than all the other songs that the Scorpions had been writing for years. They weren't really a political band per se. They were kind of an 80s hair metal act with all the preoccupations that would imply. And suddenly they go political. And they record the album for the first time in the States with an American producer. And so it was that kind of thing where, as I looked into it, and also as I looked into the history of the CIA, you know, initially I thought, what could they ever have to do with music? But of course, it turns out the CIA was very active during the Cold War in promoting certain types of culture because they thought that it would, be a threat to Soviet ideology.
And in fact, you know, if you were in a court of law arguing a point here, you'd be looking for precedent. And you give us the precedent of Marlene Dietrich in the 1940s and indeed Nina Simone a little bit later on. Just remind us of how you would argue they were used for propaganda purposes previously.
Yeah. So even before the CIA is established during World War II, when the predecessor agency was the OSS, Marlene Dietrich, who by that point was a Hollywood actress and singer, and had renounced her German citizenship, she recorded propaganda songs, basically in German, that the Allies could broadcast across Germany to try and demoralize the Nazi troops. And so Dietrich did this knowingly. She put out an album eventually called Songs I Sang for the OSS. She was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And I had not known any of this history. The more interesting case to me is later. And it's an artist who I grew up listening to and have always loved, Nina Simone, the High Priestess of Soul. in 1961, goes to Nigeria on a tour that was sponsored by this foundation in Washington. And the idea is that it's kind of African-American artists going to Africa and linking up with African artists. And Simone was quite politically radical. She was not a fan of the U.S. government and ended up actually leaving and living in Europe, kind of turning her back on the States. But we found out that the foundation that sent her was a front for the CIA. So she had been used as a pawn, and she died not knowing it.
I think it's probably a good thing that she died not knowing that, if, in fact, you're saying you have the proof of it somewhere that that is what actually happened, because she just would have balked at the idea that she was a pawn for the CIA or for the U.S. government in any way, I would have thought.
Absolutely. I mean, she was, you know, her politics were very, very radical. There's a wonderful story that her longtime guitarist told us in the podcast about when the two of them met Martin Luther King, and Nina Simone saw him coming, and from a distance she saw him, and she said to him, "I ain't nonviolent." That was the way she introduced herself to Dr. King.
What a brilliant double negative that is. And you know, the political climate is important when we think, particularly around the Scorpions and their trip, their journey to Russia behind the Iron Curtain in 1989. It was a big festival that was organized, wasn't it?
Yes. So this is another big part of the story, is that for years it had been impossible, really, for Western acts and rock acts to play Russia, to play Moscow. And then what happened is that in the summer of 89, they have this huge historic rock festival, kind of like Woodstock, but in Moscow, the Moscow Music Peace Festival. And it's the first time that this sort of thing has happened. And the thing that's funny and makes this a bit of a period piece is that most of the bands were these hard rock or heavy metal bands. Those were the kind of cultural ambassadors that were sent to perform in this at this huge Russian show. And the Scorpions were one of those bands.
Yeah, the Scorpions were one of those bands. And Ozzy Osbourne was also involved. And let's listen to a clip we found of Ozzy Osbourne speaking about that particular festival and what he saw in Russia and how it upset him.
It's a beautiful country, it really is. It's just the people in it are so miserable. I mean, what it does make me appreciate is what we have in the West. I mean, that you can't get toilet paper here, you can't get toothbrushes here, you can't buy soap. I saw a great big line of people yesterday as we were driving in for a cabbage, you know. I mean, that's ridiculous.
So there you go, Ozzy Osbourne there. I think I may have claimed we found that. Is that from the podcast itself?
It Patrick? Is from the podcast, yeah.
I do beg your pardon.
I was very pleased you played that, because there's plenty of, you know, just when you're afraid it's getting too serious, we try and spike the punch with a bit of Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah, well, he's always good to get us laughing. I mean, I find myself laughing out loud at the preposterous nature of this from time to time. You know, the idea that this could actually happen, you know. Now, I don't want to give anything away here, and I won't say how and where this occurs, but there is a point when we do hear from Klaus Meine himself, and we hear you ultimately putting a really important question to him. I'm not interested really in what he says here. I'm interested in the pause before he says anything. Let's just listen.
Klaus hasn't touched any of the snacks or drinks we ordered for him, but he seems relaxed, leaning back in his chair, like he's having a pleasant time. Or at least, like he doesn't mind going through the motions. But now, it's time to ask him if he's ever been an agent for the CIA. We heard a rumor that there was some kind of connection between the CIA and your band.
No.
Have you ever heard anything like that?
No.
No?
No. No.
You've never heard that?
Never heard that.
Connection in all these years.
Between the CIA...
Some kind of connection.
And the band.
I mean, specifically, it was that there was some sort of connection between the CIA and that song, Wind of Change.
No. Really?
Yeah.
Tell me the story.
Well, so the story was that they had something to do with the creation of the song, somehow.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
You've never heard this?
No, I never heard
it. Are you surprised?
I'm very much surprised. This is new.
Klaus Meine there in a clip from Wind of Change. How many times, I should have done this before we come, how many times does he say no in that?
And with a different inflection each time.
And like any good actor, he leaves a pause before he says anything.
He left a very long pause. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you played that because the for me, you know, you can imagine Klaus Meine had become like the Wizard of Oz, right? On some level, he's this guy that I've been obsessing over for years and just gathering all this evidence. I sometimes thought it was as if I was spying on him. Hmm. And then I came and I posed the question. And on the one hand, you know, he denies it. And of course, if it were true, he would deny it.
Yeah.
If it's not true, he would deny it. And then he did it in this wonderfully enigmatic way.
Well, I think it's a phenomenal performance, if it is a performance on his part, or else it's he was phenomenally taken aback, and that could well be the case as well. So I'll come back to then this my Durchbahn Lomgren Durchbahn Lehi theory, and I know you touch on this in the podcast as well. But your friend Michael, I mean, you, let's face it, Patrick, have dealt with the intelligence community in the past, and you've investigated the intelligence community in the past in your very serious investigative journalism work. What if the CIA, in fact, said to Michael, who is a CIA operative for these purposes, do you know what we need you to do now? Would you get to that Keefe guy? Would you get him off our backs? Would you lead him up some, you know, wild, on some big goose chase? Oh, look, tell him that Wind of Change, tell him we wrote that. Yeah. Tell him the CIA wrote that and get him to spend 10 years working on that. That'll occupy him for a while. Do you think there's a possibility that your friend Michael...
Believe me, the thought has occurred to me. I mean, this is the thing is when once you open the door to this kind of thinking, then anything's possible. And part of what I was trying to capture in the podcast, hopefully in a fun way, is that it's all a bit of a hall of mirrors, right? Once you start asking these questions, it could be that, you know, that somebody got to Michael and Michael's telling me stories, or somebody got to Oliver and Oliver's telling Michael stories. Or somebody got to the guy who told the story to Oliver. And you just begin to question everything and wondering, you know, always, who's the secret agent in the room?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's exactly the feeling I had. And I had a lot of fun getting that feeling. Real privilege and joy to speak with you this evening. That's Patrick Radden Keefe there speaking to us about all 8 episodes of Wind of Change. They're available to listen to now on Spotify. Well, not right now. Wait until we're finished, please. The series is also available on other platforms where it is being released weekly on an episode by episode basis. You know, some of you listening may have time on your hands, some of you, of course, may not. But chances are that many of you have contemplated creative writing and indeed creative writing courses of some form or another at some point along the way. Well, the UCD Festival at Home takes place this weekend. And on Friday, the writer and performer Dave Rudden will take part in the Masters of Their Art event, which will look at approaches to creative writing and ask whether you need to have studied creative writing to be successful at it. Dave Rudden joins me now on the line, along with the writer Hazel Gerner, who might give us a slightly different perspective on creative writing courses, and we will discuss what can be gained or indeed not gained from the courses themselves. Dave, we'll start with you. You did the creative writing MA in UCD. Now, just give us the chronology of this. You'd been writing for a while at the time.
Yes, so I started off doing spoken word nights around Dublin. We're kind of lucky in Dublin that it has a great spoken word and live poetry scene. So that's where I started with small pieces of fiction and poetry. And it was maybe about 3 years into doing this, I'd gotten a couple of small publications and journals. And I thought, okay, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to be serious with being an author, I need someone else to tell me I'm good. So I applied for the Creative Writing Masters in UCD.
So was it about really seeking some kind of affirmation? Was that the initial impetus?
There was a few different things. Like I was going to writing groups. I had gone to some writing classes and I thought, now I was nowhere near thinking I was in any way good, but I thought that like maybe if I worked at this, I might be able to make something of it. And I knew for myself, somebody who was only writing when it felt good and when it was easy, that if I was going to do this, I had to be really serious about it. So the masters in UCD, I had gone to the launch of Colin Barrett's Young Skins in Hodgenfigus, and I heard the then head of the course, James Ryan, speak. And I was just blown away by his compassion and incisiveness. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try this course and see whether I, first of all, see whether I could get in. I actually didn't think that I would. And it kind of all went from there.
And you know, given what area did you want to write in, first of all? And was there something specifically with the MA, with the UCD course, rather the UCD MA, that made you think, yeah, this is the course for me? Apart from that, obviously, inspiring speech from James Ryan at that launch.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things when you're getting started off, not even with a master's, is looking at the course that's there and deciding whether it's right for you. And so I knew, I was kind of lucky that I've always known I wanted to write fantasy and science fiction. And I was able to look at the different masters in different universities and see which ones had a module on that. And so UCD had a folklore and fantasy module taught by Eilish Ní Gwiomhna. And so that really kind of sealed it for me that this was something that I could work with.
Hazel Gaynor there then. Now, you're not part of this event in UCD, Hazel, but we wanted to get a different perspective on perhaps the creative writing courses and roots into writing. Your story, your arrival at writing is different from Dave's. Give us a sense of how you got there.
A little bit different, yes. So I came to writing very much as a second career. My first novel was self-published, and I suppose my master's, if you want to look at it that way, was sort of sitting down at the kitchen table early in the morning before my children woke up and just writing as many words as I could get down within the time that I had available to me. And it was very much a leap of faith, I think, self-publishing that first novel. And part of that was allowing me the creative freedom, I think, to then write a second novel. My ultimate goal was to have a traditional Big Five publisher, which is what I subsequently achieved with the first and second novels going to HarperCollins in the US. So I suppose my apprenticeship was writing that first book and learning how to do that, learning what it takes to have the discipline to sit and write when we don't have time. You know, lots of people are talking about having time now to write their novel in lockdown, and I'm wondering where on earth they're finding that time from, because I seem to have less time than ever. But it's, I think a lot of writing, of course, there's the craft of actually getting the words out of your head and onto the page, but a lot of it is also understanding the discipline, the hard work, the self-belief that it takes to keep writing.
Do you think, though, in some ways, perhaps then, Hazel, the fact that you came to writing as a second career, you had another career behind you, and I presume with at least the level of success that you were getting in and out of work every day and keeping your family life, balancing all of that at the same time, do you think that you came to writing a little bit later on, that perhaps the experiences that you had had in your previous job fed into it as a kind of a training? What was the previous job, by the way, if you don't mind me asking that?
Yeah, so I worked in professional services firms, accountancy firms, law firms in London and then in Dublin when I moved to Ireland in 2001. So I think I had very good grounding in, I suppose, the business aspect of publishing. And I think we often overlook that when we're talking about creative writing. You know, there is that lovely art, you know, finding your story, finding your voice, crafting beautiful prose on the page. But then there is a process of getting that story into readers' hands. And that is very much a business. I think my previous career has really helped me to understand the business side of publishing. And that's where I think sometimes writing courses can be really helpful, as well as helping on the craft side, the business side of publishing and the nuts and bolts of that.
Was that part of the course in UCD, Dave? Did you get much of a sense or much of an idea of how to literally go about this, you know, how to present your material, how to get an agent, how to get a publisher, how to move things in that direction? How important was that in the course?
Yes. So, I mean, the discipline that Hazel speaks about is something that I entirely lacked until I did this whole getting up in the early in the morning thing. I just completely didn't have it. I was a disheveled, useless poet, basically. And when I got into the master's, I suddenly, you know, I spent quite a lot of money getting in there. I had to take it really seriously, and we were very lucky that the not the course was focused on your work, and it was focused on telling a story. It wasn't a sort of a factory line for producing writers, but we did have publishers and authors and agents come in and speak to us and give us a sense of continuity that we were. I think you're just as legitimate a writer if all you want to do is write for yourself and want to keep your work hidden. But if you do want to get published, there is a whole industry and ecosystem out there that you have to become a part of and you have to learn about. And the Masters started me very much on that road, just this idea that you weren't writing for yourself, you were writing for an audience. And in particular, there is a gap between what you think you are saying and what people are reading on the page, and how to narrow that gap and be aware of what you're saying constantly. So that was really useful.
Yeah, I'm wondering, again, Hazel, in terms of your previous occupation, you talked about your involvement in accountancy. You know, I'm thinking of writing up a report, an accountant's report, perhaps on a balance sheet or something like that. The last thing you want in that is detail that doesn't need to be there. You need to be very precise in how you're in the type of descriptions that you would use and how you would present things, you know, in any kind of presentation in a professional sense. Did you have those sort of skills coming to sitting down at the table early in the morning before the rest of the family got up?
I think so, yeah, and certainly I learned a healthy level of brevity from working for a law firm, you know, what being very precise about what's on the page and stripping out what doesn't need to be there. So although I never intended at that point in my life to blend that into a creative writing career, and it seems like the two do not go together at all, but I think it was discipline, yeah, sort of looking at what did I really want to say and how to say it in the most effective way. And I think whether that's in a legal format or in a creative format, it's good discipline. And I also think, actually, I've been a voracious reader all of my life. And I think sometimes we don't often talk enough about how important it is to read when you're being a writer, to learn and absorb from how everybody else does it. And I'm sure Dave's the same. We're all magpies, really, and we're all fascinated endlessly. I'm just publishing my 9th novel, and I'm endlessly fascinated by how anyone else does it. I want to be reassured that they're still struggling 8 and 9 books in. And I think that's where being amongst other writers in a writing course can give you that sense of, okay, it's not just me. And that's really reassuring. And that's a really great part of participating in a creative writing event, whether that's online, listening to people being in a classroom, which we used to do in days gone by, however it is that you best want to absorb, just interact with the community and sort of learn by osmosis as well as by writing.
Yeah, and what's interesting in that respect is, even though you didn't come through a writing course situation yourself, Hazel, you are you teach now, and you're a mentor through something called the Inspiration Project. What's involved there?
Yeah, so again, this is something that I set up with two other writers in Ireland, Carmel Harrington and Catherine Ryan Howard. And the three of us all came to writing through these sort of very different circuitous routes. And we've all achieved success internationally. And we sat down and said, you know, what would have been really helpful to us starting out? What do we wish we had known at the beginning that would have helped? So we started the Inspiration Project very much with that in mind, to be very honest and sort of remove some of the mystique around a career as a writer. And what does the editorial process actually look like? What does an acquisitions meeting look like? So we've had over 100 people at various events around the country over the last couple of years. We've had to now move, obviously, a lot of that online. So we're doing a monthly blog called The Inspiration Diaries, where we sort of share an insight into how we're managing to write through lockdown, and three aspiring writers as well who are being very honest, and people are loving hearing how they're approaching this as well. So The Inspiration Project has been our sort of way to give back to the writing community what we wish we'd had, if you like, when we started out as naive young things a long time ago.
And the inspirationproject.ie is the website there, am I right with that? Yeah,
that's right, yes.
Dave, again, Hazel brings up something interesting in that when she talks about honesty and being honest with each other. This is something that I often wonder about in a writing course, or indeed workshops of any kind, where you have your compatriots critiquing your work, and they need to be honest in their critique, but they need to also not tear the bottom out of you, you know, so that your confidence is shattered.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I really feel you can learn. And this is something that made me very glad that my first experience of getting edited was not the Masters, because when I went in, I was able to say to people, look, tear it to shreds. I need to know what's good and what's bad, because otherwise I can't get better. And that had been built from, you know, getting up in pubs and telling stories or doing poetry and having people, you know, boo or throw things and learning that kind of on the fly. And this is, you know, people talk about the, you know, this kind of the construction criticism sandwich, where you say one good thing, one bad thing, one good thing, and how you maybe ask questions as opposed to saying this doesn't make any sense, or just going, what were you trying to do here, as opposed to what you're doing? And like, it never goes away. I got copy edits for a short story today, and I took one look at it and I had to put the file hidden somewhere in my computer, and I was like, that's a tomorrow problem. But yeah, just have to be like, I teach a lot of creative writing classes, especially with young people, and there is a way to tell them what's not working and show them that this is not a flaw in their story, but it's an opportunity to show off, it's an opportunity to get better. And you know, you will get people who come to writing courses not to be criticized, but to tell you how good they are. And what Hazel was saying about reading, and like, you get people saying, oh, I don't read other people's books, I wouldn't want to pollute my talent. And you're like,
right.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, well, maybe read it and don't let it pollute your talent. Just get on with your own thing then after that might be a good idea. That's Dave Rudden and Hazel Gaynor speaking to me there. And as I said, you can find out more about Hazel's Inspiration Project on inspirationproject.ie. Meanwhile, Masters of Their Art, which Dave Rudden will be taking part in, it's part of the UCD Festival at Home. It kicks off tomorrow, 21st of May, runs through until Saturday the 23rd. Dave Rudden in conversation with Anne Griffin and Helen Cullen on Friday the 22nd from 6 through until 7. And you can register on festival.ucd.ie. It's staggering to think that Stephen King sold his first short story, The Glass Floor, back in 1967. His first novel, Carrie, followed in 1973. The undisputed master of horror has published some 50 books since then, the latest of which is called If It Bleeds. It's a collection of four novellas. Chris Wasser has been reading it for us. He joins me now. Four tales in If It Bleeds: Mr. Harrigan's Phone, The Life of Chuck, Rat, and the title story itself, which is by far the longest. King himself, Chris, describes the book as a short novel accompanied by a trio of novellas. So how do you see it?
I have watched him describe it as that, Sean, and I tend to disagree. I kind of look at it as just, not just, but another collection of short stories. And despite the fact that If It Bleeds, which focuses on and is the first solo outing for a King fan favourite, and indeed a King favourite character, Holly Gibney, the detective from the Bill Hodges' Mr. Mercedes novels, and also who featured in The Outsider, although If It Bleeds is the longest entry in the book, it's just, you know, it's also another short story. So this is by no means a novel. It's King's latest collection of short stories. And for me, that's a very good thing, because although he is, you know, most famous for his novels, for his doorstoppers of novels, you know, think of the likes of It, think of The Stand, some of his most famous works and some of my favorite Stephen King works have been his short stories. I mean, you mentioned there the fact that, you know, he had his first short story published all that time ago, back in the late 1960s. It's astonishing the novellas he's put out since then. Some of my favorites have been Different Seasons, which of course contained Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, which obviously was made into a very famous film, The Shawshank Redemption. The Body, which was made into Stand By Me, going all the way through to 2015 and The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, which was Stephen King at his best. These short, snappy, spooky bedtime stories. And I know you kind of described them there in the at the top as the undisputed master of horror, but you might be surprised to learn that, you know, given despite the title of this latest collection, If It Bleeds, this is probably the sweetest and most tender writing I've ever seen from Stephen King.
Well, let's get a sample of it then. We have Stephen King himself reading the opening section of If It Bleeds.
Pineborough Township is a community not far from Pittsburgh. Although much of western Pennsylvania is farm country, Pineborough boasts a thriving downtown with just shy of 40,000 residents. As you enter the municipal city limits, you pass a gigantic bronze creation of dubious cultural merit, although the residents seem to like it. This is, according to the sign, the world's largest pine cone. There is a turnout for people who want to picnic and take pictures. Many do, some posing with their younger children on the cone scales. A small sign reads, "No children over 50 pounds on the pine cone, please." On this day, it's too cold for picnics. The Port-a-John has been taken away for the season, and the bronze creation of dubious cultural merit is decked out in blinking Christmas lights.
Stephen King there, reading from his story, or is it novella, If It Bleeds, which is the title story in this quartet that Chris Wasser is reviewing for us this evening. It's classic Stephen King, really, isn't it? It kind of lays us out geographically where we are, and it all seems very normal. But if you're in a normal American town in a Stephen King story, it's going to become abnormal fairly quickly. Maybe explain the derivation or the reason for the title, If It Bleeds, because that kind of gives us a sense of where the story goes, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know I did describe earlier this as some of the sweetest and most tender writing Stephen King has ever done. But for If It Bleeds, If It Bleeds is probably one of the most far out stories in this collection, and it centers on Holly Gibney, who, as I said before, has been a favorite of the more recent hard boiled detective stuff that Stephen King has been working on. I mean, it's crazy that after 40, 45 years of writing, Stephen King, hadn't dipped his toes in this subgenre before, but has also decided to make a new name for himself as a crime writer. And If It Bleeds features Holly, who in the Mr. Mercedes books and in The Outsider, which was recently turned into an acclaimed HBO series, she is a detective she's a private investigator who has worked under and worked with Bill Hodges from the Mr. Mercedes books. And I suppose I don't want to spoil anything for readers, but let's just say that if you've read The Outsider and if you enjoyed The Outsider, this is very much a standalone sequel, or even a spiritual sequel, in that it's taking some of the weirder, let's say, elements from the final act of that novel and kind of pushing forward with it to see what else is out there. So Holly Gibney runs the Finders Keepers private investigators company. They're kind of working on cases of when we first check in with Holly of missing dogs and the like. And all of a sudden, she is distracted. This super intelligent, slightly obsessive detective that is Holly, she's distracted by a news report of a bomb having gone off near Pittsburgh. And that was King at the top there setting the scene for this tragedy. Right. And one of the first people on the scene of this tragedy is a news reporter. And without giving anything away, Holly just becomes obsessed with this 24-hour report, and specifically with the reporter, wondering, as everyone else does, how did he get there so quickly?
And are there supernatural elements involved, I suppose, is part of the question that we ultimately ask, even though you say he's not the master of horror, but supernatural, I think, is probably reasonable enough to talk about. And it's certainly important to talk about in terms of Mr. Harrigan's phone, which starts off simply enough. 9-year-old boy gets a lottery ticket from his neighbour and wins lots of money.
He does, yeah. And much like If It Bleeds, we have a fairly grounded story, fairly grounded characters, relatable, likeable. It's a joy to see Stephen King just write about normal, regular life without any, spectral figures or supernatural monsters. But eventually, they do kind of creep their way in. And Mr. Harrigan's phone, this young boy, Craig, he's from Harlow, Maine. He's from Maine. Where else? This is Stephen King. And he develops this lovely friendship with this billionaire business type, who has settled down in this small town of 600 people to basically live out the rest of his days. And he reads to him in the afternoons, he waters his plants, he buys him a new iPhone after he wins money on a lottery ticket that was bought by him, by the old man for his birthday. And he teaches the old man, who says he knows everything about the world and about business, how to use this phone. And the old man, Mr. Harrigan, he loves the phone so much so that when he dies and young Craig is devastated, Craig is adamant that this old man is going to die with that phone in his pocket. And Craig soon learns that his correspondence and his bond with Mr. Harrigan goes beyond the grave.
Yeah, and again, classic Stephen King territory in some ways. And we're hardly surprising that in another of the stories we have a writer trying to finish his debut novel. That's a classic Stephen King setup as well. And also he ends up getting a virus when he shakes hands with the shopkeeper and has to go into self-isolation. But I want to finish up with the final story in the book, because I think this was the one that kind of sold the overall book to you. Would I be right in thinking this, The Life of Chuck?
Absolutely, because, you know, If It Bleeds, Holly Gibney, we've kind of been there. The story of a writer trying to write his novel, and also with, you know, the spread of flu, you know, Stephen King famously predicting or prophesizing like some sort of devastating pandemic, as we saw in The Stand. We've been there before. We've even been to, you know, see something like Mr. Harrigan's or read something like Mr. Harrigan's Fallen. But for the life of Chuck, this broke me. And I mean that in the best way possible. And it is astonishing that after 40 years, I found myself reading twice, as it were, a story unlike anything else he had ever written. And I was intrigued as well by the description, and also in the author's note, that Stephen King was, you know, just intrigued himself by this idea that in each of us contains the whole world, contains the whole universe. And he thought of this regular guy, this, you know, this accountant, this 39-year-old accountant named Chuck Krantz, and all the things that might have happened in this guy's life up until his death. He was going to tell this guy's life, this fictional character's life story backwards, like a film in reverse order. So when you read the first, which is essentially the final chapter, and it's just three lengthy chapters, you don't really know what's going on. You know, you get the sense that someone is on their deathbed, and then in the second chapter, this guy who you've just read about dying is stopping in the middle of a busy street to dance along to a busker. And in the third chapter, then we kind of go back to his childhood and how he's heard stories that the home he's growing up in is haunted. And nothing really that out, you know, but there is a bit of a supernatural kick towards the end of the story, but nothing really out of the ordinary happens. Okay. Instead, it just gets you. It's just Stephen King writes so elegantly about this beautiful character, about this beautiful life, and he makes you think of what it's like to have been Stephen King and to have devoted your entire life to creating an entire world.
Briefly then, and finally, Chris, clearly you love that final story. If you had your time back, would you skip the first three and just read the third one, the final one, the fourth one? Would that be your advice to readers?
I think if you go out and buy this book just for that story, it's well worth it. But I think Mr. Harrigan's Phone runs a close second. As I said, there are some freaky things going on. It's nice to see Holly Gibney again, but it is nice to see that he has developed something of a tendency in his writing all these years later.
All right, Chris. Well, so they're talking to me about If It Bleeds by Stephen King, which is published by Hodder & Stoughton. Set 7 years after the world has become a frozen wasteland, Snowpiercer centres on the remnants of humanity who inhabit a gigantic, perpetually moving train that circles the globe. Class warfare, social injustice, and the politics of survival are questioned in this television adaptation coming to novel. The series is based on the acclaimed movie of the same name, which was directed by Bong Joon-ho. Arlene Hunt has been watching Snowpiercer and she joins me now. Even if you put them all on the 1,001 carriages, I believe, on this train, Arlene, class is going to be at the very centre of it. You want to be up the front of the train, you don't want to be down the back of the train.
I think it was Paris Hilton who once said she'd never turn right on an airplane. Well, it's a little bit like this. It's 101 carriages long. It was unleashed just as the whole of the earth had dropped to 117 degrees below freezing. And Mr. Wilford, who's actually an unseen character throughout the series, he unleashes Snowpiercer. And as you said, it's a perpetually in motion train with 3,000 people on board, but not everybody who is on board was invited to be on board. So at the tail end of this train, at the very last carriage, you have a lot of people who sort of broke into the train just before it left the station and before it became before it started out on its major journey doing revolutions of the world.
And they're called the tailies. Up the front, it's a totally different if you turn left when you get onto the train, it's a totally different scenario.
Yeah, so you've got the very, very uber wealthy who are living at the front end of the train. They are the sort of the movers and shakers of the world, the people who could afford to live in the lap of luxury for as long as they need to live in the lap of luxury. Mm. And then as the carriages move down, you move down to the various different classes. And what we meet is the tailies, but we also is in the first episode, there's something going on in third class carriages, which are in the centre of the train. And the story erupts really from there.
Well, let's get a sense of how it erupts. Melanie is one of the officers on the train, played by Jennifer Connelly, and she wants to recruit Andre, played by David Diggs. He's a tailie down at the very back end of the train, and she has a problem in the third class areas. And you'll also in this clip hear the voice of Roach, played by Mike O'Malley.
Detective, I'm here to tell you personally that Mr. Wilford wants this solved quickly. Doors will open wherever your investigation leads you.
is.
2 years ago, there was another victim. Male, genitals removed.
Someone's already serving time in the drawers for it.
So, either you got a copycat, or Mr. Wilford put the wrong person in the drawers. I'll do it for rations and third-class immigration for the tail.
You're not entitled to anything here. The passengers had tickets. All the crew had jobs. You tailies boarded the train
Lee
like
Brickman,
rats.
Please. Would you uncuff him? Please. This must be very disconcerting to you. Really, it's simple. You are the only homicide detective on the train. And so, Mr. Wilford is asking you to contribute.
I'd guess when Mr. Wilford asks you to do something, he really is a quits in offer you can't refuse.
I was just about to say thing. You'd expect to wake up with a horse's head in your bed if you didn't go along with it.
Yeah, that was a clip from Snowpiercer, the new Netflix series. Jennifer Connelly playing Melanie, David Diggs playing Andre, who is very usefully the only detective on board the train. And as I said, the voice of Michael Malley within that as well. Arlene Hunt has been looking at the series for us. It's a pretty crude setup. And, you know, from I only watched the first episode now, Arlene, but I got a real sense of, you know, it's the poor people down the back, the very rich people up the front. And there's not a lot of subtlety in that portrayal. Or were they just laying things out in episode one?
Yeah, I think that because it's episode one, they sort of put everything in the kitchen sink into it to give you an idea of what's going on and the dynamics between the different carriages and the different groups. It differs if you've watched the original film in 2013. You know, it does differ from that, because this is much more. We didn't have like a police detective in the first film. It was very much a film about, you know, it was class warfare, where the people in the back of the train fought their way to get to the front of the train and get control of the engine, and in doing so get control of the train. Whereas this is very different. This has different layers and different things going on. There's obviously a lot more different characters because it's over 10 episodes. So there's a huge amount of exposition in the first episode. Being said, there's a lot of interesting characters that have been introduced. I particularly like Commander Gray, which is played by Timothy V. Murphy, which everyone sort of would probably know from the various different things he's been in over the years. But he seems to be having the time of his life playing this sort of jackbooted like thug who's in charge of things. And, you know, Alison Wright is in it. A lot of people would know her from The Americans. And she plays playing the original Tilda Swinton role. So she's, you know, these are all like Jennifer Connelly's character. These are all what they're called, the head of hospitality. Now, you heard Jennifer Connelly there. Yeah. Does she sound very hospitable to you?
No, not really. The other thing that I think, and I'm wondering, is this an addition in the series or was this there in the original film? The guards, a lot of the crew on the train are wearing uniforms that are unmistakably modelled on Nazi uniforms from the Second World War. And the tailies down the back of the train, the kind of situation they are in, terribly reminiscent of the sort of trains that brought people to concentration camps. Is there any serious political point being made around that type of thing, do you think?
I think so, because, you know, they're basically refugees on this train. If you look at it, no matter what way you look at it, they're refugees. They're unwanted. They are the unwanted on the train. They don't belong there compared to that's what everyone else considers them. They're, at one point, they're told they're basically just the dregs of society that manage to get on board. And when things do go wrong up along the train, you know, it's the tailies who suffer. You know, their rations are halved, their electricity is cut. You know, the punishments that are meted out to the people in the tailie end of things when things go wrong, or anyone tries any kind of uprising, is pretty horrific. And you'll see that from the first episode on. You'll see there's many of them have lost an arm, and it's a very, very, very harsh punishment how they lose their arm. So I don't want to give it away because it's actually quite shocking to see on screen. But there's a lot of political shenanigans going on as the series goes forward, and a lot of diving deeper into what it means to be stuck on something for 6 years, because this train is now running into its seventh year. So what they initially would have thought, people thought they'd be on the train for X amount of period of time, and then the world somehow would return to what it should have been before. And it hasn't. And actually, it's becoming more and more difficult on the train, because as they go along, you know, the earth itself is falling apart. There's a lot of, like, when they go through various sections of very rough terrain, there's landslides and avalanches, and things are not as they seem.
And also, obviously, we have the climate change as part of that story. I mentioned the political aspect within the references to World War II. But there's also this idea of the haves and the have-nots. Is that social debate explored with any subtlety?
Subtlety, I don't know if I'd say it was subtle, because the haves are the uber haves, and it's very difficult to create subtlety around people who are very upset over the fact that they can't have smoked salmon in the morning, whereas people in the tailies are worried about losing their arm and losing their children. So there is no sort of conflation between the two worlds, except that as people move up to the trains and move up to the different carriages and move up to the different third class, fourth class, you can see how people change in the television show as well, and how you can actually see the sort of degeneration of people as they reach closer to the engine.
I don't know how many episodes you've watched, Arlene. Will you be seeing it out to the end? I think it's a 10-part series, isn't it?
Yes, I think I will, because it's a little bit of a slow starter. I won't lie, it's a little bit higgledy-piggledy at the start, but it revs up very nicely after episode 3. That I will tell you. Episode 3 is terrific. That's absolutely terrific. It's really interesting, and it genuinely sort of picks up the pace very quickly then.
So you will be going back and watching it through to the end to check it out. Well, I have to tell you that a neighbour of mine said he stuck with it and then he gave up just before the end. So I'd be interested to see if that happens to you as well. That's Arlene Hunt.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, do so. That's Arlene Hunt speaking to us about Snowpiercer, which starts on Netflix on May the 25th. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy, as usual, were the researchers. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Nikki Dempsey was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Damien O'Mara. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.